CA, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
On Saturday, August 24th, it all begins again. The ecstasy.
The stadium comes alive. Alex Parikin is hype. I'm hype. I love football.
The exhilaration.
And there he goes. That man is bad. That man is fast. And he is up over the 50, still on his feet.
The heartbreak.
And Laurier wins on an absolute heartbreaker at Richardson Stadium.
The pain.
No!
All part of a long journey to football immortality for the Queen's Gaels. And on Saturday, August 24th, in Windsor, Ontario, it all begins again. 3:45 p.m. pregame show, 4 p.m. kickoff, and there's only one place you can catch all the action.
This is Queen's football on CFRC.
I'm Trevor from the Arrogant Worms, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I believe uncontroversial fact that U.S. provided arms should not be used to massacre civilians, should not be used to result in massive civilian casualties. And that is what we are seeing in Gaza.
As the official death toll in Gaza tops 40,000, the Biden administration's approved $20 billion in additional weapon sales to Israel, including 50 F-15 fighter jets. We'll speak to Josh Paul, who resigned from the State Department over President Biden's Gaza policy. Then to Colombia to look at how armed groups are increasing their control over rural areas.
Unfortunately, after a peace agreement and after an announcement by a progressive government to find total peace, I can say now that rather than total peace, what is happening in Colombia is a state of total war, where criminal autonomous territories are being established. This is sad news, but it is what is happening now.
In Burma, up to 200 Rohingya Muslims were recently killed in attacks as they attempted to flee Bangladesh. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's killed over 40,000 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th, according to Gaza's health ministry. Over a third of those, more than 16,000 Palestinians, were children. But that grim milestone is still believed to be a vast underestimate, with many buried under rubble and large numbers of Gazans facing life-threatening health emergencies. Among the dead are twin newborns, their mother and their grandmother, who were killed in an Israeli attack this week on Deir al-Balah as their father went to retrieve their birth certificates.
I was going to get the birth certificates for the children. My wife gave birth the day before yesterday. I went to get the birth certificates. I got two babies, twins. I got a call telling me that the house you were staying in got bombed. People from the neighborhood called me. My wife is gone with my two babies and my mother-in-law.
The babies were named Asser and Aysel. Their mother, Dr. Juman Arfa, a pharmacist. This comes as critical ceasefire and hostage release talks are now underway in Doha. More than 100 media workers, news outlets, and press freedom groups are calling on U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to immediately stop arming Israel. Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza has killed at least 160 journalists since October 7th, the largest death toll of media workers in any conflict, including World War II. Journalists, including Pulitzer Prize winners Laura Poitras and Spencer Ackerman, along with groups including the Courage Foundation, Defending Rights and Dissent, and Roots Action, write in a joint letter, quote, Israel's deliberate targeting of these journalists seems intended to impose a near blackout on coverage of its assault on Gaza by providing the weapons being used to deliberately kill journalists. You're complicit in one of the gravest affronts to press freedom today, they write. The embattled president of Columbia University has stepped down after just 1 year on the job. Manoush Shafiq's resignation comes in the wake of her widely condemned crackdown on campus protests against the war on Gaza, during which she called in the New York Police Department, which violently cleared tents and arrested scores of peaceful student protesters. Shafiq said, quote, "I have decided my moving on at this point would best enable Columbia to traverse the challenges ahead," unquote. She plans to return to the UK to work in international development for the Labour government. In response to the news, the Columbia chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace said, quote, "The students of Columbia will never forget the sheer violence unleashed upon us by Manoush Shafiq, and we will not be placated by her removal as the university's repression of the pro-Palestinian student movement continues," unquote. You can see our coverage of the student uprising for Palestine at Columbia and colleges across the country at democracynow.org. In related news, five University of Chicago graduates who participated in Palestinian rights protests finally received their diplomas more than 2 months after graduation. The five graduates were notified that the disciplinary cases against them had been dropped. The students were never told why they were the subject of disciplinary cases. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz has agreed to debate J.D. Vance in a CBS-hosted debate October 1st. Vance has refused to fully commit, saying only he strongly suspects he'll participate. On Wednesday, Donald Trump launched more attacks against Kamala Harris during a North Carolina rally his presidential campaign billed as a major economic address.
But to her left, I haven't heard that laugh in about a week. That's why they keep her off the stage. That's why she's disappeared. That's the laugh of a crazy person. We're not going to let this incompetent socialist lunatic keep breaking our economy for four more years. It'll destroy our country.
In more election news, the Washington Post reports Robert F. Kennedy Jr. sought a meeting with Kamala Harris to ask for a cabinet position in exchange for his endorsement. The offer was rebuffed. RFK Jr. reportedly met with Trump in July to offer his endorsement to him in exchange for a high-level public health position. A top advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has denied a report in the Wall Street Journal that his government approved a plan to blow up the Nord Stream pipelines in September of 2022. According to the Wall Street Journal, a six-member crew of Ukrainian civilians and active duty soldiers used a small rented yacht, satellite navigation, sonar, and seabed maps to reach the Nord Stream pipelines in the bottom of the Baltic Sea, where divers used an explosive known as HMX and timer-controlled detonators to rupture the pipelines, triggering a massive release of methane gas. The blast severed three of the four pipelines that carried Russian gas to Europe. President Zelensky reportedly approved the plan, but later sought to halt it after a Dutch intelligence agency learned of the plot and informed the CIA. Zelensky's commander-in-chief, Valery Zaluzhny, who was leading the effort, reportedly forged ahead with the plan despite Zelensky's U-turn. In Tanzania, senior opposition leaders have been freed on bail after their arrest alongside more than 500 young activists who were barred on Monday from staging a rally marking International Youth Day. Among those detained in the crackdown was Freeman Mbowe, a presidential candidate and leader of the Tanzanian opposition party Chadema. Earlier this year, Tanzania's president Samia Hassan lifted a ban on opposition gatherings that had been in place since 2016. But on Monday, authorities said they would not allow protests to continue, citing weeks of youth-led anti-government demonstrations in neighboring Kenya. The World Health Organization declared Mpox a global public health emergency after an outbreak of the viral disease in the Democratic Republic of the Congo spread to a dozen other African countries. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the threat of cross-border spread remains high.
It's clear that a coordinated international response is essential to stop these outbreaks and save lives. A public health emergency of international concern is the highest level of alarm under international health law.
workers with the United Farm Workers, the Union of Southern Service Workers, Starbucks Workers United, and others are organizing around the United States under the banner of Heat Week, demanding protections from extreme heat. Earlier this month, a 36-year-old sanitation worker in Baltimore, Maryland, Ronald Silver, collapsed and died while on the job as the heat index reached 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, here in New York, a climate protester was taken to the hospital Wednesday after a Citibank security guard punched him in the face while he was documenting a peaceful demonstration as part of the Summer of Heat campaign. Climate activists have been taking peaceful actions at Citibank's Manhattan headquarters all summer. Citibank's invested nearly $400 billion into fossil fuel projects since the Paris Climate Agreement was adopted in 2015. Half of Puerto Rico was left dark Wednesday as Tropical Storm Ernesto downed power lines and dumped more than 10 inches of rain on some parts of the island. Thousands have been left without access to running water amid soaring temperatures, with the heat index approaching 110 degrees Fahrenheit. The for-profit company operating Puerto Rico's grid, Luma Energy, said it was focused on restoring power to hospitals and essential services like water and sanitation. It's the latest in a series of power outages since Puerto Rico privatized its electrical grid in the wake of 2017's devastating Hurricane Maria. Despite the persistent blackouts, Puerto Ricans pay some of the highest electricity rates in the United States. And in Afghanistan, Taliban rulers held a military parade in Kabul, marching through Bagram, the former U.S. airbase, to mark 3 years since their return to power. The U.N.'s warned of a worsening humanitarian disaster in Afghanistan and a gender apartheid where women and girls have largely disappeared from public life. Meanwhile, Afghans are calling on the U.S. and Europe to release billions of dollars of frozen Afghan assets.
These billions of dollars that are frozen are not related to the Emirate government, but belong to the entire Afghan nation. The Western powers ruled over us for 20 years, did bomb blasts, and killed Afghans. They did not hesitate, and now they want to destroy us through poverty.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Health officials in Gaza say the official death toll from Israel's 10-month war has now topped 40,000, but that figure is widely believed to be an undercount. We begin today's show looking at how the Biden administration has just approved $20 billion in additional weapon sales to Israel. The weapon sales will include 50 F-15 fighter jets, tank ammunition, high explosive mortars, tactical vehicles, and advanced air-to-air missiles. The State Department approved the sales despite growing calls for the U.S. to impose an arms embargo on Israel. In April, the majority of nations on the UN Human Rights Council supported a resolution calling for all countries to halt weapon sales to Israel to, quote, prevent further violations of international humanitarian law and violations and abuses of human rights.
On Wednesday, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders appeared on CNN and criticized President Biden's support of Israel.
I believe that the Biden administration has been probably the most progressive administration in the United States since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Biden said he wanted to do that, and I think he has kept his word, and Kamala Harris has been by his side. So on domestic issues, they have a whole lot to be proud of. But I think the president has been wrong in terms of his support for Netanyahu. I happen to agree with the International Criminal Court that what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza, the massive killings, the destruction of the healthcare system, the destruction of housing, the bombing of every university, and now creating a situation where tens of thousands of children face starvation. The United States, in my view, should not be providing another nickel to Netanyahu and his war machine. That's my view. President Biden disagrees with that. Do I think that will have an impact among young people? Among some progressives, I do. But at the end of the day, I think most progressives will say he is wrong. The president is wrong on Gaza. But the alternative is Donald Trump, and that is not an acceptable alternative. So we've got to keep pushing the administration to change its views regarding funding for the Israeli war machine. But we have got to defeat Donald Trump and elect Kamala Harris.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders appearing on CNN. We're joined right now by Josh Paul, veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned last year in protest of the push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its assault on Gaza. He's a former director of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department, where he worked for 11 years. He's now a senior advisor at Dawn. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Josh. Thanks so much for joining us. I wanted to ask you about this $20 billion. Now, that announcement came just after last weekend when the Israeli military struck a school with a mosque within it. Over 100 Palestinians were killed. And CNN confirmed that a U.S.-made GBU-39 small-diameter bomb was used in that strike, which resulted in, quote, over 100 pieces of people, as was described by one Palestinian journalist. They couldn't find a whole body intact afterwards. It was after that that the U.S. announced they would be moving ahead on $3.5 billion in military sales to Israel. And then a day later, announcing the $20 billion sale. Can you explain what this is all about?
Well, sadly, I think this is just a continuation of a policy that has been going on now for 10 months of the U.S. providing to Israel all the arms that it requests. The only difference is that for months, the administration has been functioning with sales that have already been notified to Congress and so hasn't had to go back publicly. Now it has to go back publicly because it has reached the limits of those previous authorizations. I don't know how one looks at that bombing of the school that you described or the killing of the twin babies that you just described at the top of your show, or indeed at the Israeli government officials who are advocating for the rape of detainees and go ahead and provide these weapons and then look yourself in the mirror. It is a dark day for American foreign policy and a stain, I think.
And Josh Paul, could you talk about the date, the time lag between when the weapons will actually be delivered? The Associated Press noted the weapons are not expected to get to Israel anytime soon. There are contracts that will take years to fulfill. So can the sale still be contested and even stopped?
Sure. So first of all, on the timing of the deliveries, the F-15s will take at least 3 to 5 years to build and will not be delivered until 2029. What is interesting in the notifications is that very unusually, the notifications also include delivery dates for the tank and mortar ammunition. The dates in the notification say 2026. That is the manufacturer's delivery date. Once the sale is approved, there is nothing to stop the U.S. government from providing these same equipment, the same munitions, out of U.S. Army stocks, and then backfilling itself as the supplies come off the production line. So I think that we could very well see some of these deliveries occurring within weeks. In terms of what can be done about this, first, let's look at the timing. You know, these sales have been pending for several weeks, several months in some cases. It's interesting that they come after Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit. That is a way, I think, of avoiding having sort of congressional action ongoing to try and block these sales while he was here. They also come several months before the election in the dead of August. And I think that that is also an intentional act by the administration to try and put some space between these sales and the friction that they will cause with much of the Democratic base and those upcoming elections. I think it's also worth noting, of course, that the one thing Prime Minister Netanyahu actually made a solid ask for when he spoke before Congress was for faster weapons transfers. And by giving him precisely that, the Biden administration is not only, giving Prime Minister Netanyahu again what he wants, but also strengthening Prime Minister Netanyahu's hand domestically, letting him show Israel that he can come to America, make a demand, and have it met. And I think that is extremely disruptive, not only to the pressure or any pressure we are trying to place to push Israel towards a ceasefire agreement, but also towards that ceasefire agreement itself. Why should Prime Minister Netanyahu make any concessions when the U.S. continues to do everything he asks us to? Finally, yes, so there are steps Congress can take. Unfortunately, the administration has notified these sales during a congressional recess. There are 15 days until the administration can move forward with offering what we call the letters of offer and acceptance, essentially the contracts to Israel. Congress will not have returned in time to prevent that. But once it is back, Congress can introduce and the Senate can introduce joint resolutions of disapproval to attempt to block these sales. Those will not succeed, but they will prompt a much overdue debate on the Senate floor.
Also, though, the timing of this being right before the Democratic convention, where protests are planned for the Biden administration, well, that is President Biden and Vice President Harris, the Biden administration's support of Netanyahu with these Israel military sales. Why would they do this right before?
Well, I think that, look, first of all, there's no good time to do this from any perspective, right? I think that they are coordinating and continuing to walk a very tight line between demonstrating what will be, I do expect, a President Harris's continuing support for Israel, while also trying to lean into arguments about the need for increased humanitarian assistance, the need for a ceasefire. And I think we will see the Harris camp speak more to those sorts of issues. But, you know, at the same time, President Biden remains the president, and this is his policy, and there have not been any changes to it.
Talk more about that, the ceasefire. New round of Gaza ceasefire and hostage talks are beginning today in Doha, Qatar. The talks are being organized by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar. Hamas has said it will not send representatives to the talks. A senior Hamas official told Reuters, quote, going to new negotiations allows the occupation to impose new conditions and employ the maze of negotiation to conduct more massacres. The talks are the first to be held since Israel assassinated Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh, who had been Hamas's chief negotiator. So if you could comment, Josh Paul, on what you think the significance of these talks are and the fact that actually Secretary of State Blinken was scheduled to be in the Middle East but has now postponed his visit.
Well, first of all, let us hope and pray that these talks succeed because Gaza desperately needs an immediate and permanent ceasefire. And while Secretary Blinken may not be there, CIA Director Bill Burns, who is an extremely capable diplomat, will be there. So I think we should all hope. At the same time, as you just mentioned, of course, you know, within the last few weeks, Israel killed the leader of Hamas and also their lead negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh. And that does not seem like the action of a government that is intent on recovering its hostages from Hamas's grip. You know, one does not kill the person you are negotiating with and then expect to achieve a ceasefire. So I think the odds remain very long. I think it also remains very much in Prime Minister Netanyahu's domestic political interest, as he sees it, that he not be seen to be making any sorts of concessions to Hamas. So I am, unfortunately, as I think most of us are, very skeptical that we will see a breakthrough. But let us hope that we do.
In a moment, we're going to be talking about what's happening in Colombia, but we want to bring Jan Egeland into this discussion with Josh Paul, Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, who is joining us from Bogota, Colombia. But we wanted to ask you, as you've long called for a ceasefire, and on this day, when the death toll in Gaza has topped 40,000 Palestinians, expected, in fact, to be far higher than that. Your thoughts on the U.S. right now approving, moving forward with $20 billion in arms sales to Israel?
Well, I must say, for me, as a humanitarian with lots of humanitarian colleagues on the ground in Gaza, I find it incomprehensible that the U.S. is continuing to provide indiscriminate weapons to an indiscriminate warfare in a place that where the population is trapped. There is no escape from Gaza, and where we are prevented from really helping them with sufficient humanitarian aid. There should be no more arms going into that place before there is a ceasefire.
Well, I'd like to go back to Josh Paul to talk about U.S. arms sales also to Saudi Arabia. The Biden administration has decided to resume sending offensive arms to Saudi Arabia, lifting a ban that had been in place since 2021. The U.S. had halted offensive arms sales 3 years ago amid public outcry over Saudi Arabia's role in the devastating war in Yemen. Josh Paul, your response to that decision by the Biden administration?
Well, I think it's just another example of the elevation of politics over human life. These air-to-ground munitions And the transfer of air-to-ground munitions from the U.S. to Saudi were, as you say, halted in the context of what have been tens of thousands of civilian casualties caused by U.S. weapons at the hands of the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. You know, we have seen no evidence to date that the Royal Saudi Air Force, if faced with the same context, would act any differently. Yes, the United States has worked to make the Saudi Air Force and enable them to be more accurate. But the big question is, would they be any more discriminate? And I don't think we've seen anything to suggest that the Saudi Air Force would act in a different way. And so advancing these weapon sales is really an olive branch from the Biden administration to try and keep Saudi Arabia on side as they continue to push this normalization deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel and this security pact between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. It's a sign that, hey, you know, please hang in there. We're still working on this. Unfortunately, it could very well come at the cost of future civilian lives.
Well, Josh Paul, we want to thank you for being with us. Veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned in protest over the push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its assault on Gaza. He's former director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs of the State Department, where he worked for 11 years, now a senior advisor at Dawn. Coming up, we'll continue with Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, about what's happening in Colombia today. And we'll also talk to him about Sudan, where peace talks are supposed to be underway in Geneva. Stay with us.
What is life? How do we live? What should we take? Should we give, or there are more questions than answers? Pictures in my mind will not show. There are more questions than answers. And the more I find out, the less I know. Yeah, the more I find out, the less I know.
There are more questions than answers by Johnny Nash. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We're continuing our conversation with Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's joining us from Bogota, Colombia, where he has been looking at how armed groups are increasing their control over sections of Colombia. According to the Norwegian Refugee Council, over 8 million Colombians live in areas where armed groups are operating. That's a 70% increase from 2021. Around 5 million Colombians remain internally displaced 8 years after the 2016 peace deal. The violence in Colombia has forced many people to flee the country, often by passing through the treacherous Darien Gap, which is located between Colombia and Panama.
In addition to Jan Egeland, we're joined by Manuel Rosenthal. He's a Colombian physician and activist with more than 40 years of involvement in grassroots political organizing with youth, indigenous communities, and urban and rural social movements. Has been exiled several times for his political activities. Rosenthal is part of the group Pueblos en Camino, or People on the Path. Jan Egeland, let's begin with you. Explain why the Norwegian Refugee Council, why you as its head, are in Colombia right now.
Because it's one of the largest humanitarian crises on earth, really, and it's completely overlooked by the wider world, and it's happening in the midst of the Western Hemisphere. I just came back late last night from a journey deep into the Nariño rainforest. This is the southwest corner of Colombia, and met there Indian tribes that are at the point of extermination because of the continued armed conflicts between there are eight armed conflicts in Colombia between the many armed groups and also with the army, and there are all sorts of drug cartels that are fueled by the drug trade. So are the many armed groups, and the civilian population is in the crossfire. So I'm really shaken by seeing how many people are now completely unprotected in a widening armed conflict. Many of the unprotected, by the way, are also refugees, Venezuelans, migrants, trekking north for protection and on their way, they hope, to North America.
Jan Eglin, could you speak specifically about the impact of these multiple conflicts on the Amazon region? Deforestation in the Colombian Amazon has been surging, and some data suggests that deforestation in the region is 40% higher than it was last year as a consequence of the conflicts in the area. So if you could talk about the groups whom you spoke to there, the indigenous groups, and why it is that the conflict is especially devastating in that region.
It's because there is no state. They call it ausencia de Estado here, that there is no state apparatus, no state services, public force and order in large parts of Colombia, which is a beautiful country with enormous rainforests, mountains, pristine nature. Some 80 indigenous groups are really at the point of extermination. Their culture is gone, really, because they have been displaced by their land, by these armed groups and the drug lords. Often there is an overlap between them for land, for the coca trade. There is an increase in narcotics production, and the narcotics is the fuel for the violence, and the civilian population that is not protected are displaced. We are some humanitarian groups that are doing our very best to help. I went 4 hours with my colleagues in boat up the rivers to meet some of these indigenous groups and the Afro-Colombian communities. And they are completely suffering alone. We can give them some humanitarian aid, but we can't give them protection. And then we see that these people who have all the arms in the world are burning down the forest, displacing the people, and working with complete impunity.
I want to bring Manuel Rosenthal into this conversation, the Colombian physician and activist, to talk about the root causes of the violence, Manuel, and to talk about what the government is doing. There are negotiations around ceasefires with armed factions, including the FARC, and how significant is U.S. involvement in any of this?
Thank you. Good morning. And it's good to hear Jan Eglin's voice. We remember him well here from his previous stay in Colombia. Yes, one of the things I'd like to add to Mr. Eglin's comments now is, yes, for sure, what he says is absolutely true in terms of COCA and the different armed factions. But one has to remember that when the peace agreement was signed between FARC and the Colombian government, even prior to this agreement that was signed in 2016, enormous oil extracting concessions were made to transnational corporations within the entire Amazon region. So one has to add these factors to begin to explain what is going on. I'll give you an image of what Mr. Eglin is describing. Colombia is becoming a series, or could become, if it continues in this direction, it could become a series of autonomous criminal territories, huge territories, not only rural, but certainly rural with the data that we've been provided already, but urban and rural. Armed factions, it doesn't matter, they can portray themselves as right, left, involved in drug trade, etc. Huge armed factions are linked to local mafias that are also connected to government positions and to the state. And these connections, these assemblies, are taking over territories and controlling populations in a way such that, for example, if you see that there's a decrease in the number of assassinations, kidnappings, etc., it usually means that these armed factions have gained control over the territories and they have established a violent form of government and state. So there is an absence of a state that we could refer to as the ideal state that provides health, education, protection, etc. But there is a presence of a different kind of state being established in Colombia. And it is that way, and it can happen that way, on the background of extreme social inequalities, extreme poverty that pushed people into two types of economies, illegal economies. One is surviving through what's available, and that's the coca marijuana production. Colombia produces 92% of global cocaine and nearly as much of the marijuana. And then the other type of economy is war itself. If you're recruited, you receive some kind of income, or you make it. So this is our state. There's no absence of a state. This is the state in Colombia. And it's linked to, in many cases and in many territories, linked to the form of government and state that traditionally has been engaged in these kinds of activities. So I had this combination. Now, the U.S. involvement in this, I just make one simple, small comment, and that comment is General Laura Richardson, who is the Pentagon in charge of the U.S. South Command, has made it very clear that the interest in this region, the entire region, includes the Amazon and other territories for resources. So it is the old imperial discourse in terms of a competition against the Chinese and the Russians for the control of these territories, and the main and only interest is extractive. The rest is just discourse. So this is what we're living through. Amy, in fact, I was just remembering, as I was listening to Mr. Eglant, your book on Nigeria years ago. I'm in northern Cauca. Mr. Eglant knows that what's going on here is the same as in Nariño. And what we lived through is what you described in Nigeria, when you were stopped by armed people and you weren't killed by miracle because your life was in their hands. This is the power and the government and the state in Colombia. The rest is discourse and an image. It's no different from what's happening with barbecue in Haiti, although in a different degree, but with specificities.
Jan Eglant, could you first of all talk about what Manuel said, but also what officials in the Colombian government you met with, if any, and what they told you, what steps they're taking to address this massive humanitarian crisis?
Manuel is right, of course, and he describes well this complete lack of protection for civilians and the insecurity where
It seems that we've lost Jan Eglant at the moment. So, Manuel, if you could talk about the government of President Gustavo Petro and the policies that the government has had with respect to these multiple armed conflicts and the crisis that's been unfolding, his policy of total peace and what came of that.
The intentions of this government are excellent, and that's why he received this massive support. And his initial proposal as a candidate was total peace, and that's what he's acting on. Total peace means negotiating with any and all armed actors. Some are political actors or portray themselves to be political, and the armed insurgencies, and the other ones are criminal groups. So he offered a differential approach to each one of them. One would go and submit themselves to justice with favorable conditions in exchange for peace. The others would negotiate a political solution after the peace agreement was signed in Colombia, not kept by the government, and led to not one armed faction of FARC, but many armed factions. So in this context, Petro offers this process and begins to work on this. The problem with President Petro's proposal is twofold. One is a repetition of the mistake made, I think intentionally, by President Santos, who is a Nobel laureate, which was a negotiation that excluded the population. It was a negotiation between the armed factions on behalf of the people to distribute the country and the country's resources between them. And then, of course, that wasn't kept by the governments that came back. Now, Petro is doing the same. He's negotiating with the armed factions and the communities and populations who suffer these, as Mr. Eglin exposed, are being essentially ignored. So that's one mistake. The second mistake, and it's a huge mistake, is precisely in a discourse addressing the drug economy and the extractivist economy, but in practice, not developing real, concrete, viable, feasible alternatives to this. And he is within a government that is actually under the control of a state that has become an authoritarian mafia type structure. So it couldn't work. But the intentions are good, the discourse is good, but people are feeling desperate on the ground.
Well, we have Jan Eglin back now in studio in Bogota. Jan Eglin, if you could continue what you were saying earlier and speak about your meetings with officials in Colombia.
It is true that the government is trying to do a lot to bring peace and bring development to all of these vulnerable groups. But the point is that since the agreement in 2016, which brought so much hope and the Nobel Prize to President Santos, as Manuel said, the FARC did demobilize, but then lots of other groups took their space, took the territory, took the drug trade, and there was no government to help bring an alternative development, alternative services to the people. So there was a vacuum, and that was filled by other armed men, and some of them are now back from the FARC. I will meet today, and the government needs then to do much more and work more effectively with the international community. I will meet the diplomats here in Bogota today, and I would say to them, listen, we have less funding today for development projects, for humanitarian relief, for support to Indian tribes at the point of extermination. There is less support for the alternative to war than there was before, and it's being ignored that people are giving up hope in Venezuela next door, in large parts of Colombia, in Ecuador, in Central America, and many other parts of the world. So of course, people will be tracking north for hope and a better life in the north. If you don't give people hope where they are and security where they are, of course they will wander north to the US, to Canada, to Mexico. I would do so in the same situation if there was no hope for me and my family, or a better life and some protection against violence.
Jan Eglin, before you go, I wanted to ask you about another country, about Sudan. As the U.S.-led peace talks have begun in Geneva, Switzerland, there are conflicting reports on the state of the talks today. According to the BBC, neither the Sudanese army nor the rapid support forces took part in this first day of talks. But there are reports that the RSF did send a negotiating team to Geneva, though it's unclear if they showed up at the talks. Last week, you wrote on social media, Sudan's man-made mass deaths must and can stop. If you can respond to what's happening in Geneva, and if you hold out any hope.
We had high hopes for
the Geneva talks because the situation in Sudan is so desperate. It's the first man-made famine on a watch for half a generation. In the Zamzam camp in northern Darfur, it's 500,000 people there, and they are dying in masses because of starvation and because of blunt violence. The talks is not really on at all because the two sides do not seem to care for the people that they say they represent, which means there has to be much more pressure on the two sides in the Sudanese conflict. It's a little bit like the Gaza situation that we also discussed. Neither Netanyahu nor Hamas have an interest in making peace. It's very clear. So the US, the West, the regional powers have to make much more pressure on the parties, just like the Gulf states, the neighbors to Sudan, and others have to make much more pressure on the two sides in Sudan so that they end this absolutely senseless war before the whole civilization in Sudan is torn to pieces.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Bogota, the capital of Colombia. We also want to thank Manuel Rosenthal, Colombian physician and activist, speaking to us from northern Cauca in Colombia. Coming up, we look at Burma, where up to 200 Rohingya Muslims were recently killed in attacks as they attempted to flee to Bangladesh. We'll get the latest. Stay with us. Guaneña by Omar Flores de Armas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at Burma, where up to 200 Rohingya Muslims were recently killed in drone strikes as they attempted to flee to Bangladesh. This comes amid intensifying conflict between the military junta and the Arakan Army, a rebel-armed group. Survivors of the drone strikes accused the Arakan Army of carrying out the assault, while the rebel group blamed the military junta, which overthrew Burma's elected government in 2021. A new report from Human Rights Watch finds the military and rebel-armed groups have committed extrajudicial killings, unlawful recruitment for combat, and widespread arson against Rohingya Muslims and other civilians in the area.
During last week's drone attack, many Rohingya also died while trying to escape by sea. This is an account by one man who lost five children after they drowned while trying to flee the attack by boat.
Starting at 5 p.m. on August 5th, the Arakan Army fired weapons incessantly. The next morning, on August 6th, for survival, we decided to flee to Bangladesh. So I decided firstly to flee a family with a small boat. Then a big boat will be sent. My family got on a small boat. My sister's family also got on there. While fleeing, one boat sank. The people from that boat dragged down the boat we were on, and the boat we were on sank too. Only 6 to 7 survived out of almost 40. From my family, my 5 children, 4 children from my sister's family were lost, and other elderly youths and women were lost.
We're joined right now by Nathan Nguyen. He is co-founder of the Free Rohingya Coalition. He's joining us from Frankfurt, Germany. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what happened, but also for a global audience, put this into a larger context? If you can hear Nathan Nguyen, can you hear us here in New York? Let's go to another clip as we try to make a connection with Nathan Nguyen. In the latest wave of violence against Burma's Rohingyas, thousands in Rakhine State in Burma were forced to flee as their homes were burnt down overnight. This was in May. This is Saifur Rahman, a 30-year-old Rohingya father who managed to flee to Bangladesh and escape the violence with his wife and their two young children.
The Arakan army set fire to our house. They were firing guns randomly and rapidly. I had a brother who got arrested and later was shot dead. I don't know where my parents are now, probably dead. My wife and I whisked our two children and ran to the main road to save our lives and never looked back. We went to different villages across the mountains, keeping a low profile, and eventually managed to come here to Bangladesh. Tens of thousands, all people from the surrounding villages were escaping the attack. Nobody was looking back. We were running to save our lives.
So if we could turn now to Nathan Nguyen, who is joining us from Frankfurt, Germany. We just played two clips. If you can talk about the latest attack on the Rohingya and put it in a larger context of what's happening in Burma today.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. So, as you have mentioned about the Naf River massacre, where the more than 200 Rohingya were massacred by the drone strike by the Arakan army, that happened on August 5th. As of now, the Mongdo downtown, the urban area has been empty as of today morning. And the Arakan army soldiers are in the town. They are looting the Rohingya houses. And the Rohingya are, you know, what they call the evacuated. But it is actually forcibly relocated to somewhere else. They are now at the border where the Myanmar military junta has built the temporary camp. Most of the people are there, and some of the people are relocated to some other villages. So there are some fighting still ongoing, but and like before. Let me talk a little bit about this Mondo town. Since the early June, the Arakan army has been fighting against the military there, but whenever they launch the drone attack or the artillery attack, they target the Rohingya people. The military base is opposite direction of the Rohingya villages, but still, every day they target the Rohingya village. Every day there were two or three, sometimes five, six Rohingya were killed, many injured. So on August 3rd, since the, you know, their this drone strike increased, on August 5th, in the afternoon, the people decided to flee to Bangladesh. Then they gather at the bank of the Naf River. Around at 5 p.m., the Arakan army is dropped the drone bomb and resulted the more than 200 dead and the many injured. And also, at the same time, when a boat tried to flee from there, they dropped the drone bomb, and as a result, only two survived. There were more than 20 people on board. Next day morning, just now you have played the clip. He's the survivor of the from the boat, you know. So we think at least, including that this dead from the boat, I think at least 250 were die, including this Naf River massacre. This is the scale of the killing is compared to the Budirang Township. It is the small scale. In Budirang Township, before the May 17, the Arakan Army has committed the significant massacre in different villages. In one single village on May 2nd, they killed more than 600 people. I spoke to some survivor, only a few people survived, and the eyewitness and the people who know about this massacre. I have also got the family list. So they have committed the same massacre in the different village as well. In Budirang alone, they have killed more than 2,000 and they have burned down the more than 8,500 Rohingya houses. So in Mondo, the same thing they are doing. They have the intention to cleanse the Rohingya people. That we can prove if we read the article that published in the Foreign Policy magazine 10 years ago, and also the 6 years ago, the elder brother of the Arakan Army chief, delivered his speech in the private meeting, which leaked to the the social media. In this speech, he said, we have to strategize to cleanse the Rohingya from, they call the Bengali, these people from the Budirang and Mondo Township. This is what exactly they are doing now. What they are doing is they are, they're carrying out the unfinished business of the Myanmar military.
And if you could explain, Ne San Luen, the origins of this crisis, the historical context with the crisis, the Rohingya crisis beginning in August 2017.
Well, the Rohingya genocide began in 1978, more than 45 years ago. So the massive violence against in 2017 is not the first one. The first one occurred in 1978, then again in 1991, 1992, and 2012, 2016. The latest wave was in 2017. So it is the very long decade persecution by the Myanmar military to cleanse the entire population from the country. As of now, only about the 600,000 remain in the country. So the Arakan Army is trying to cleanse about 300,000 who are remained in the Budirang and the Mondo Township. These are the Rohingya majority area. Normally, before the 2017, there were more than 1 million people there. But in 2017, Myanmar military cleansed about 750,000 and more than 10,000 were killed. Hundreds of women and girls were raped. So as of now, the humanitarian situation is very dire. There are no humanitarian agency present, and the people are depending on the money sent by their relative live in the diaspora. And also,
what is the relationship between the Arakan Army and the Burma military? And you're saying Myanmar, we are saying Burma. It's the same country. The military regime renamed Myanmar.
True. So they don't have the relation. The Arakan Army is fighting against the military since the late 2018 in Rakhine State. So they had the on and off the ceasefire. But since last year, November, they have been continuously fighting against the military. But they are the enemy each other. But when it comes to the Rohingya issue, they have the same intention. The Arakan Army has also same intention as the Burmese military. Burma military. That is why they are now cleaning in the Rohingya. They have killed in 3 months of time, in four months of time, they have killed more than 2,500 Rohingya in two townships and displaced around 300,000 Rohingya now.
And what should the international community do at this point? And does the student uprising in Bangladesh that ultimately threw out the prime minister there, does it have an impact on Burma and what's happening there?
Well, that the Burmese people, especially the people who are working to bring back the democracy in Myanmar, and also the younger people engaging with in the Spring Revolution. They are very happy and they are congratulating the Bangladeshi student. They have seen the real change in Bangladesh. So they are also hoping. But the problem with the international community, well, when it comes to the Burma, the international community is letting the Burmese military to enjoy the impunity until now. You know, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, the U.S. government determined the crime against Rohingya as a genocide and the crime against humanity, but nothing followed. So all the, you know, the, this justice avenue, they have to take the serious action against the Myanmar military and end the impunity. So since the international community is failing again and again on the Rohingya, the Arakan army is also committing the same crime. You know, whatever they have committed against the Rohingya is amounted to crime against humanity and the war crime. So they think they will